Hi, I'm Nicholas Carey, your host today, and welcome to the Blockchain.com podcast. I'm the co-founder of Blockchain.com and the founding commissioner for the Blockchain Commission for Sustainable Development. I also authored The Future is Decentralized. Today, we'll be joining my co-host, Dr. Derek Heilman. He's the head of research here at Blockchain.com and one of the world's most cited cryptocurrency and blockchain technology researchers. We have a very special guest today. Please welcome Anthony Scaramucci. Anthony is an American financier, the founder of SkyBridge Capital, and the former White House communications director. He serves on the Council of Foreign Relations and has recently been making the rounds across all major media outlets to talk about Bitcoin and SkyBridge Bitcoin Fund. Thanks for tuning in today, and if you like what you hear, please subscribe and share this podcast. So one of the first things we ask new teammates here at Blockchain.com when they join is, how did they earn their first buck? And then what are they doing now? And so we'd love to ask you that question. How did you earn your first buck? And then what are you focusing your time on these days?
So my first dollar was, I was 11 years old and I sold seeds for the American Seed Company. And so if you're old enough, you could Google that. It was on the back page of the comics. And so what they did was they sent you a package of seeds and, you know, you went out and you went door to door to sell seeds to your mom's friends, which was ridiculous. I was selling like watermelon and pumpkin seeds to my mom's friends and like little geranium seeds. And then I earned $7.54. And then I literally took the $7.54 and put them in an envelope and mailed them back to the company for a watch, which I still have, which is about this big. And it's a picture of Neil Armstrong on the moon. And the seconds is the flag going back and forth. Okay. And so that is something I kept with me. And so the second thing, you didn't ask me the second thing, but it's more seminal for me because that's how I became an entrepreneur, is at 11 and a half, my dad was struggling. He was, his hours were reduced. He was a crane operator. We were in a recession. So it was the mid 70s. And I went out at 11 and a half years old and got myself a Long Island newspaper route for Long Island Newsday, when they allowed paper boys to carry the papers. And I started with 26 houses. And when I left that route to play baseball at age 13, after Tom Seaver got traded to the goddamn Reds, something I'll never forget, June 15th, 1970, '77, brutal day, June 15th, 1977. Never forget it. I quit the route. I had 122 houses. So I had the largest paper route in the town, Port Washington. I was making $46 a week. I was giving about 30 of those dollars to my parents and keeping 16 for myself. So what am I doing now? I'm doing the same goddamn thing now. I'm knocking on people's doors and I'm asking them for their money. And that's what I was doing at age 11. So doing the same thing today that I was in 1975, 6, and 7.
I love it. We all start off as entrepreneurs and then end up taking different paths. I think we used to get that newspaper in Suffolk County on Long Island. So, all right, well, we need to all learn. How did you first hear about Bitcoin? And then what was sort of your journey to developing the conviction to, one, put your own capital behind it, but then to build products for your clients?
So there were two things that happened to me. In May of 2014, the Winklevosses came to my conference, the SALT conference, and they sat with me and they made a presentation about Bitcoin and the blockchain and why they were heavily investing in the digital currency space and why they believed that this was a revolution. And I remember sitting with them in the green room after their presentation and saying, okay, I think you guys are onto something, but it's hard to store. It hasn't fully scaled. It seems like there's a lot of competitors that are going to be competing for this space. And I said to them, and I remember it vividly, I'm more of an institutionalist. I'd gone to Tufts, went to Harvard, grew up at Goldman Sachs before I started my businesses. But basically my businesses are applying an institutional process to money management for wealthy individuals and institutions. And so It didn't meet the boxes. I couldn't check the boxes of Bitcoin being acceptable in that crossover space for Institutional Prime Time in 2014. I then went to Singularity University. I don't know if you know Peter Diamandis and Ray Kurzweil. Yep. I was there with my oldest son. I did a 10-day executive seminar there. And I remember writing in the notebook. I can't remember who made the presentation on the blockchain.
It might have been me. I was an adjunct professor of Singularity University, but I don't remember being there.
Yeah, so. That was September of 2014. I don't think it was you, because I think it was somebody from the UAE, actually. It was, but in any event, I could probably find his name somewhere. I have it in my notebook. But I remember writing down in my notebook, if the following three things happen, I will set up a Bitcoin fund. Do you want to hear the three things?
Definitely.
Okay, the first thing was it had to be a scalable network. It had to have a crossover point of at least 100 million users globally. I mean, you guys know better than me, but it feels like there's 150 or so million users. I'm not 100% sure. You probably would know better. And so I had to get it, that had to be done, because then what happens is, if you understand Neil Ferguson's book on money, what happens is you have enough of a population globally that are accepting that tender for value transfer. And so again, you guys know more about this than me, but putting it simplistically to my clients, we are traditionally transferring something that is worth way less than our goods and services. I have paper in my pocket right now. It's got some nylon in it. It's mostly cotton fabric. It's got the American nonsense on it. These are, just for all of you non-Italians that are listening, let me show you. This is an Italian single. See that? Okay, Tony Soprano would be like, okay, see? That's an Italian single, see? So you always, if you're Italian and you grew up on Long Island, you always have these in your pocket. You never know when the hell you're going to need them, okay? But these are pieces of paper, okay? And they have the government's name on them, but you know that it's fiat currency. So the government's not backing it with gold. There's nothing other than the standing of the government. Now, the government's got a military and the government's got a Federal Reserve banking system. So those things are good. But ultimately, what makes somebody want to take this piece of paper for a pizza or to cut my grass is that they believe they can exchange this piece of paper with somebody else for services and goods that they want. And so if you step back and you look at it from that system, and Neil Ferguson describes it beautifully in his book, Wampum, Seashells, Gold coins with political figures' profiles stamped on them, they became acceptable uses of tender. And that ultimately is a ledger. And so what Bitcoin has brilliantly done in a decentralized way, which makes it very important that it's decentralized, they've created this tender and they've created this impregnable system through the blockchain. And so I wrote down 100 million users. Second thing I wrote down was had to be legitimate enough where the government, and if you're libertarians out there listening, you don't like me saying this, but I'm an institutionalist. The government's got to tax it or want to regulate it. Okay, now libertarians don't like that, but I like that because now I know that it's acceptable to what will eventually be the institutional community. That's happening. And then the third thing was storage. I didn't like the notion that I could buy this thing, I could put it on my USB or it could be on my SIM card, and I had this value. But, you know, God forbid I misplace my phone or upgrade my phone. I forget to transfer the thing over my SIM card, whatever it might be. And lo and behold, you know, you've got 21 million coins, but you guys know 2 to 3 million, maybe even more than that, have disappeared as a result of failure to store properly. And so when Fidelity came on board with Fidelity Digital Assets, I'm very close to those guys, a lot of business with them since I left Goldman. I said, okay, Eureka, here is the perfect opportunity. I can have Fidelity backstop us. Okay, now let's build a better mousetrap, or at least the best mousetrap that we can build from a regulatory framework in the United States. So what is that? It's a LP. It's 75 basis points versus funds that are out there at 1.5% or 2%. It doesn't trade, but in the flip side of it not trading, you don't have that 20 to 30% premium. That's something, say, like the Grayscale Trust has. But now you can own it. You can own it in our fund. It has the security of Fidelity, the insurance wrapper of Lloyd's in London. It's audited by Ernst & Young. And we've got Davis Polk & Wardwell Blue Chip law firm overseeing everything for you. We have daily subscriptions, but we have, because of the way limited partnership law works in the US, you can't trade limited partnerships. So we have it limited to the duration of 90 days. But I'm okay with that because I'm trying to condition my clients to buy and hold it and just relax and accept that this is a transformative thing that's happening in the world. So those things happened, and we put $400 million into it, $25 million of our own money into the fund, the Bitcoin fund, Skybridge Bitcoin Fund. And, you know, we've raised some money. We're heading towards $100 million now in that Bitcoin fund. Some of it's appreciation and some of it is new assets.
Amazing.
So that's the odyssey that I've been on.
The three moments that you've been waiting for, or ones that we've been watching develop, you know, since 2011 when we got started in this space. You know, we have 65 million users now. Developing legitimacy has been critical to us. We have Anthony Jenkins, former group CEO of Barclays, on the board of blockchain.com, who saw the early opportunity to help shape and bring legitimacy to the whole space, knowing that it would take time, but wanting to participate in that. And I'm finding those curious, clever people has been huge along the way. And the last is that storage thing. I think that's a big deal. You need to have the storage continuum from end users that want to be able to transact with anybody else in the world to more sophisticated and institutional ones. And we're grateful to see all the incredible work you guys have done there. I read this incredible statistic that something like 23.6% of all US dollars ever created in the history of America were made in the last 12 months. So I want to, you know, pivot over to Garrick, who spent a lot of time thinking about currencies and alternative currencies. Give you an opportunity to ask a question maybe in that domain and get Anthony's perspective on it.
Thanks, Nick. Anthony, as Nick mentioned, you know, we've had this incredible monetary expansion, fiscal expansion, on top of what was already, as we've commented on, a world war level of public debt that existed prior to the start of the pandemic. How much is that really driving institutional adoption and the story? Is that, you know, 90% of what's attracting, you know, the investors that you're talking to the space? What's your thought there?
Okay, so I'm really right now gear shifting to try to figure out how wonky you guys would like me to be. And so I'm going to go with medium wonky or mama bear wonky.
You're among some nerds. It's okay.
So what I would say to you about dollar volume and the production of dollars is, if that's going to be the legal tender of trade and it is the reserve currency, weirdly, I'm okay with the production of dollars in the following sense. We are creating wealth in our society over 5,500 years of human progress, and a result of which the wealth has to be denominated in something. And so each day when a new building is put up around the world, each day when a new technology is transformed, there is additional wealth in the society. So if you go back, and to be a little wonky with you, if you go back to Neil Ferguson's book, the reserve currency should have some level of elasticity in it, and you have to grow the reserve currency. So when people say to me, well, Bitcoin is going to be the global currency and we'll measure them in Satoshis, that may happen. I'm not saying that it won't happen, but one of the complicating factors for Bitcoin to allow that to happen is the lack of supply. I see Bitcoin, frankly, more as a store of value akin to gold. And I would say, and I've said this, I think it's better at being gold than gold is at being gold. It's digital, it's portable, it's easy to save, it's all of those things. And so therefore, to me, it's a innovation technologically, the same way the phone that our grandparents were using was perhaps a rotary phone. We now have more computing power than got Neil Armstrong onto the moon in our hands. So of course your currency or your store of value should also be technologically improved. But if you're making the point about dollars being produced for the sake of the production for policy reasons, that's a different issue. And I think that's a dangerous issue. And so dollars should naturally be expanded as wealth gets expanded around the world. But if you're just producing dollars because you're going to use that as a policy solve, S-A-L-V-E, now you've got a totally different issue. And you're going to have very bad deleterious side effects to that. And one of the side effects is going to be the fraying of the social contract, and particularly the social contract in democracies, because the dollar, what happens, the people that own the assets, you're creating more dollars, 23.6% more dollars. those assets nominally are going to go up. The Hamptons real estate, the house that you'd like to buy in that exclusive area, the artwork, you pick the things that are scarce, they're going to go up. So you're making the case that Bitcoin is going to go up because it's a very scarce thing. And we can talk about why. But the secondary thing is the United States and other democracies, we have very weak, cowardly politicians at this point. We don't have the Churchills and the Roosevelts or even the Reagans. So what we have is a group of jackasses who are overly reliant on central banks to help them with their problems. Because if you had the financial crisis, you could have added a touch of regulation, a touch of jobs training, a renewal of our industrial policy, and you could have started an infrastructure plan that would have helped to rebuild and reshape the American economy. We didn't do that because these guys are fighting all day and night. You can't even get the Senate transferred over to the Democrats. They're doing all types of procedural things to delay that. They don't want Merrick Garland in as the Department of Justice head, Attorney General, until the impeachment process is over because they're trying to get that swept under the rug, even though Donald Trump is a domestic terrorist and an insurrectionist. So he'll likely be acquitted, even though he deserves to go to jail. And so you've got all these weak politicians. And so that's going to be a very, very big problem for the world. Until we get a strengthening of that situation, it'll be a very big problem for the world. And so I can build a case for you why Bitcoin is going to be so important in a world that has disarray of Western leadership. There's a struggle going on in some of the world's biggest autocracies. See what's going on with Navalny in Russia. The denial of Bitcoin in places like India, making it prohibitive legally, or in China, actually makes Bitcoin more powerful. As a weird effect of making it more powerful, because what do we know about dynamic market forces when the government tries to block them, black markets develop, or ancillary activity develops. So I could build a case for you guys why Bitcoin is going to be a legitimate, it already is, but it will be even a more legitimate store of value over the next 5 years. And so therefore, if gold is trading at $12 trillion, and let's call Bitcoin, for the sake of this argument, I'm just looking at the price right now, $800 billion. If gold's at $12 trillion, let's say that we're wrong by half and Bitcoin gets to $6 trillion. So there you go. There's your opportunity. You know, you have a mega opportunity ahead of you. And remember, if there's 48 million millionaires globally, you only have 21 million coins. We know that perhaps 3 million have disappeared. So you don't even have one Bitcoin per millionaire in the world. So for that and so many other reasons, Bitcoin is here to stay. I've had my eureka moment. I'll tell you something that's ironic. And I told this to the Winklevosses, to Cameron and Tyler. I'm more comfortable with Bitcoin at 30,000, 36, 37,000 than I was at 400. Because at 36, 37,000, it's scaled, it's liquid, it has slayed 8,300 potential crypto competitors over its 12-year odyssey. It has become the monetary standardized network. If Amazon is the retail network, and Google is the ad and search network, and Facebook with the other additional ecosystems like WhatsApp and the ecosystem of Instagram is the social network. Well, Bitcoin has become the monetary network. And so, and it's scaling. And so we know it's going to scale exponentially. And I think that we're in the early, early innings. This is the first top of the first pitch has been thrown. This isn't, we're not even in the game yet. You know, we were in the farm system at 400, but we're in the early, early innings of the major leagues at 37,000.
I think that's a great metaphor. Institutional news, there's so much coming these days, it's almost impossible to keep track of it, but I did see an unconfirmed headline about Dave Swenson at Yale and Harvard and some other major endowments possibly taking another adoption step and going beyond the investments they made in venture funds and actually owning crypto directly. And I just wondered if you could speak about that topic and also something that, you know, someone who spent time in universities, you know, the kind of is a little bizarre to me is why is it the biggest endowments that are making these asymmetric bets first rather than the smaller universities like a Cambridge where I worked in the UK that needs to catch up to the Yales and the Harvards? Why is it so hard to get maybe some of those smaller universities to make this asymmetric play first?
Funny caveat, I made the first donation to a university in the United States' history, and it took me 12 months to get them to be convinced to accept Bitcoin back in 2014, and then they immediately sold it. So if they had kept it, it would be worth over $1 million, say.
And what university did you send that to?
That was the University of Puget Sound. Gareth and I, I'm sure.
Yep, out in Seattle. Yeah. So look, I mean, it's an interesting, it's fascinating discussion. And so this has to do with neuroplasticity. This has to do with bureaucratic thinking and institutionalized thinking. This has to do with CYA, which we all know what that means. And it has to do with Harvard and Yale hiring some super talented people. They figured out if you got a $40, $50 billion endowment, let's go for the big enchilada. Let's hire the smartest people that we can that will be open to that frontier. I don't think he would mind me saying this. I think you guys know who Byron Wien is. Byron Wien is a friend of mine. He's been a mentor of mine. He's almost 90. And he was on one of my webinars last week, and he was asking the most questions. And Byron Wien is neurally plastic. He's open to the fact that even though he's 90, the world order is shifting, and he's open to being adaptable to the shift in that world order. He's open to it. Warren Buffett, on the other hand, he's 90. He's decided that Bitcoin is rat poison. And he's explaining why it's rat poison, because ultimately to him, it's not worth anything. It's a cryptograph on a cloud somewhere or in a storage facility somewhere. And so how could that be worth anything? Okay. He's also somebody that would tell you that gold isn't worth anything, by the way. He would say to you, well, all the gold mined, if you put it in a cube, it's worth 10 Exxon Mobils and 10 times the farmland of the United States, which is rather on the farmland than the gold. And so, you know, and people say, okay, yeah, we'd rather own the farmland because it's more productive and it's doing those things. But what he's missing, in my opinion, is something that Bill Miller said, which is, yeah, it may be rat poison, but the rat poison may be killing the rat, and the rat may be fiat currency. And so where I'm going with all this is, of course, you're going to have people that dislike it or feel that they missed it, or even if they don't know a lot about it, they'll rail on it the same way the horseless carriage was railed on, the same way the fad of the talkies when we were in the silent movie era and some people were experimenting with something known as talkies. People said, okay, well, that's not going to last. And the same way that we're dealing with all these new technologies. So to me, those schools are perfect for us. Why? Because we're ahead of those schools and we can educate those schools and we can get them comfortable with what I am saying, that this is a network. Forget about that cryptograph that we're going to store in cold storage somewhere at Fidelity so that it's unclipped from the internet and it's impregnable from hacking. It is a network. It is a superhighway of traffic for people. You know, the coin is valuable because of that network. And I can build a case for you that as that network expands, go back, do a regression analysis, wherever those coins were in 2014, look at the number of users, look at the number of people that own those coins, look at the coin today, and look at what's happening even in the last year. There's been exponential growth in the number of people that want to own those coins or participate in that network and see the value proposition of that network. So no, those universities aren't there yet. Yale, Harvard, and Brown have confirmed that they own Bitcoin. So I know you read the story, but yes, that's been confirmed. And I think that they're taking the position that even if it's a small piece for them, owning a piece of this futuristic monetary network will be of value to them while they're watching the proliferation of fiat currency. And I would submit to anybody here, go look at your bank account. What do you got? You've got numerical digits in your bank account. They make you feel rich if you're rich. You look at those numerical digits, you can wire them or transfer those numerical digits somewhere. If you want to buy a Mercedes, You wire those numerical digits, they go down in your account, they go up at Mercedes, and there you go. What'd you give them? You gave them numerical digits backed by this stuff, right? That's what you gave them, okay? Okay, you tell me, is that value? I don't know, but it's the idea that we both exchange and understand it to be value that makes it valuable. And so we're there, we're gonna create this, we're gonna educate these people. This will be part of our future. Our children are already there. They don't give a shit about the 5,500 years of gold. They know Bitcoin and they realize how easy it is to store Bitcoin and to buy and hold Bitcoin. And so, you know, these coins are going up. They'll be several hundred thousand dollars per coin, okay, over the next 3 to 5 years. And I want my clients to be a part of it. But having said that, you know, it's volatile. It's going to move around a lot. I'm telling clients 1 to 3%. I'm not telling them to bet the ranch. There are people probably listening to you guys. They're Bitcoin maximalists. All they do is they make a dollar, they put it into Bitcoin. I get it. But I'm an incrementalist. I'm trying to get people that are fuddy-duddies and old fogies out of the 60-40 stock and bond portfolio into thinking about the world of alternatives and using Bitcoin as a piece of that alternative story.
Yep. I just had one more before I hand this back over to Nick, and it builds on exactly what we're talking about. Is we've seen Wall Street investors, we've seen endowments, you know, come into crypto. There is a final domino or investor category that I think is still at least not officially invested, and that is the public sector and sovereign wealth funds. And I wanted to ask you, Anthony, as someone who's worked in government, how can governments think about investing in Bitcoin, maybe out reallocating some of their gold holdings, and doing so in a way that doesn't trigger financial instability, particularly if it's a larger country, a systemically important financial institution? It certainly is one thing if a Barbados or a smaller country makes this move, but can in Italy, can you know, a major government do this, and how should they do this? Have you thought about that, had those discussions?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I haven't, I mean, to be very candid, I haven't had those discussions yet. I have had the corporate discussions. I have met with CEOs and treasurers and CFOs to talk about why they need to have some Bitcoin on their balance sheet. Because if you're looking at these numerical digits and you're producing 23.6% of them in 6 months, and we know you're going to produce more of them in the next 6 months, and so therefore, you know that the dollar, which we used to think of as a store of value, may not be a store of value, you know, and if you look back to 1971, when we unpinned it from gold, right now, $2 of 1971 dollars has the purchasing power of $100 of 2021 dollars. I'll tell you something, guys, that'll make you laugh. You could have purchased for $2 in 1935 a Monopoly board. And Monopoly came with 5,000 paper dollars. You know, some of them were white. And remember, the orange ones had 500 on them and the white ones had a dollar on them. And right now, you could go on eBay and buy that 1935 Monopoly game. And those dollars are worth $50. And so ironically, Monopoly money is actually worth more over the years than fiat currency is. Okay, that's the irony of the whole thing, okay? Because it's an antique and it's scarce. So, you know, where I'm going with all this is, will the sovereign wealth funds get there? Yes. Are they gonna get there last? Probably, because they're all tied to fiat currency. You know, pick the UAE, Saudi. You want to pick the big ones, Norway, they all have a fiat currency at the governmental level that makes them wary. And in the United States, if you want to read a great book that would accompany Neil Ferguson's book, Money, you read Treasury Wars. And this is what the US Treasury did to our money. They weaponized it over the last 20 years since 9/11. They were using it as a weapon prior to that, but they've really honed in on it. And so they don't want this currency that we're describing, or this store of value describing as Bitcoin, to leap ahead of them, because they're using fiat currency still as a weapon in the system. So I don't know if that's answering the question well enough, or you guys are satisfied with the answer. I'm less optimistic about their adoption today, but I'm more optimistic about individuals, entrepreneurs, very smart CIOs at places like Yale and Harvard. I'm very optimistic about CFOs. Right now, as you and I are speaking, my friend Michael Saylor is hosting an institutional conference for, it's supposed to be 1,400 people. It looks like it's going to be close to 3,000. And we'll pick up some traffic in our fund from that because, you know, gap accounting, Bitcoin is still an intangible asset. So let me explain that very quickly to your listeners. If I put Bitcoin on my balance sheet on MicroStrategies, it's an intangible asset. I can't mark it up. If I bought it at 16,000, that's what it is for book purposes on my balance sheet. If it goes down to 8,000, I have to mark it down. But I can't mark it up because it's an intangible. But if I buy the SkyBridge Bitcoin fund because it has an LP wrapper around it, all of a sudden it can be marked to market pursuant to GAAP accounting. Now, Michael Saylor doesn't care about that, but there are other companies that do. So we'll pick up traffic from there. But I don't see the sovereign funds getting into this thing in scale anytime soon.
Thank you.
And by the way, I hope I'm wrong with that. I certainly hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, the corporate treasury moving into crypto is a big one. For every MicroStrategy that's publicly talking about what they're doing, there's more than a dozen firms that are not publicly announcing it. So that's a big one. Thank you so much for joining us tonight and today, depending on where you are in the world, sobering history on the American purchasing power of the dollar. But I think also the opportunity is really there for the entrepreneurs to seize the day and build a better form of money for everybody. So Anthony, we welcome you to the community and appreciate everything you're doing over there with SkyBridge.
Thank you.
Awesome work. And thanks for joining us tonight.
I hope I see you guys soon in the live setting. Okay.
Yeah.
We can transfer fiat currency for food and booze. Okay.
That's yeah, I will happily buy you a pint in London next time you're over across the pond. So thanks again.
Sounds good.